Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. Tabletop games are ordinary and extraordinary. Ordinary because they're everywhere. Extraordinary for precisely the same reason. They're everywhere, in every civilization, everywhere in the world, across all recorded human history. In his new book, Across the Board, How Games Make Us Human, tabletop game aficionado Tim Clare explores games as familiar to us as Monopoly or chess, as niche as Magic the Gathering, and as unexpected as the Japanese poetry-matching card game Karuta. We learn about games as recreation and as ritual, and above all, we see how they can be a way for us to come together. Tim Clare is an author, poet, and presenter of the podcast for writers, Death of a Thousand Cuts. He's written two fantasy novels, The Honors and The Ice House. His nonfiction book about failed writers, We Can't All Be Astronauts, won Best Biography and Memoir at the East Anglian Book Awards. Tim Clare, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
So, I want to talk a little bit about your biography, how you got into games and why. You had a piece in The Guardian last year, talked about your late in life diagnosis of with autism, and I just want to quote you here from the book. Growing up, games were my refuge from a baffling, unpredictable, and hostile world. Here, briefly, things made sense. Is that's part of your attraction to games?
Yeah, I think games have always been a really safe place for me to come back to, and I know for many people, they don't feel like that at all. They can feel complex or threatening, but partially maybe because they were always something I played around the table with my dad. And so I have that association of it being a time that I got to spend with my dad doing something that we both enjoyed, a bonding time. For me, yeah, I think that's where a lot of it began, was having this space where sometimes we didn't have to say anything at all, but we could be together and cooperate in an activity that we both really loved.
Yeah, I appreciated that article and some of the glimpses into your life from the book. To kind of help us understand what things are like. So for example, later in the book, just in passing, you say you were in the school orchestra, but you were unable to read music and unable to play a note. So you mimed, right? And then you make a connection. You say, that's how I've survived as an adult.
Yeah, that's really astute that you picked up on that, actually, because that was, a little aside that I put in. I didn't know if people would notice. But yeah, I found a lot of things like playing the violin, which I did for 4 years, and I felt so ashamed that I didn't get it, that I just didn't tell anyone that I wasn't enjoying it or understanding it, and I just tried to keep my head down and not get noticed that I couldn't play. And I think it's true for a lot of people, but particularly for people who maybe are on the autistic spectrum or have a difference like that, that you're spending a lot of your time watching what other people are doing, desperately trying to copy them to fit in while not totally understanding. Actually, it's a funny, because I think that is also true a lot of the time for people playing a board game. I think a lot of people have had the experience of hearing the rules explanation for a board game and it's not sinking in. They're not understanding at all what they're being told, and they're looking and no one else is saying anything, and they kind of think, I'm just going to start the game and see if it starts to make sense when we start to play, but up until then I'm going to bluff.
I think, yeah, for some people it's kind of stressful. Like, I've got to learn something new, right? Then I might not be good at it, right? But for others, like yourself, it's, I guess there's a structure there that really helps.
Yeah, I review board games every month, and I have to learn and teach new games all the time. And I want to say right now, I still find it stressful learning a new game sometimes. I still get nervous. I still hear that teach and go, and my mind started wandering and I snap back into attention. I'm like, wait, what's going on? And then people are like, okay, let's play. And I'm like, I don't understand what's going on. So I still experience that to an extent. But what I've learned over time actually is having a kind of confidence that it will eventually make sense. And I think that's the difference, is going through that and repeating it over and over. I have a confidence now that at some point the pieces are going to click into place. And at that point, right, then it starts to feel empowering, because I have done something that wasn't intrinsically easy. And now each game, you know, feels like learning a new language to an extent. And so with any mastery experience, there's also going to be the learning period where you don't feel like you know so much. But yeah, once you've got it, once it's clicked in, then there's a sense of structure and a sense of confidence. Confidence doesn't have to come from something being super easy right off the bat. It can come from overcoming something that you thought at first was a bit challenging.
Just one more thing from your bio, from this article in The Guardian. You say, in early adulthood, I left board games behind, mostly as a part of a doomed project to reinvent myself as normal bloke, capitalized, who watched football and liked beer. In my absence, games underwent a revolution. So at some point you came back, and you do note that since about the 90s, right, there's been a golden age in board games.
Yeah, I think often the kind of classic start of the current golden age in board games was 25 years ago with the release of the German dental technician Klaus Teuber's title Settlers of Catan, which is now just known as Catan. That's often seen as the beginning of the modern era of board games. This game that, you know, I think most people can get their heads around. I don't think it's hugely complex, but just felt like a step change in terms of quality of design and originality of design. Now, I don't think it was necessarily it's not that there weren't games before then that were really good. It's just that it was a game that was simultaneously well designed, relatively speaking, and it found an audience. It found popularity. I think it sold over 40 million copies now. So that, you know, you think about the cultural footprint of a game like that. Most of the Beatles albums didn't sell that many copies. So this is a game that has had a big impact on global culture.
You're right. Games like poetry are an invitation to break away from the tyranny of efficiency. Then you go on to say they're pointless but vital. That's a good description. Their vital usefulness, I guess, comes from the fact that they aren't vital, that they aren't part of the, you know, the to-do list, the putting out the fires you have to do in everyday life.
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary, Tom. And I what I want to say is that I get a bit defensive about it in a way that can seem sort of over the top, but I feel often nowadays, if you ever see, say, a commercial advertising a children's toy, it'll say aids normal cognitive development, helps social skills, builds math skills or whatever, helps develop language skills. And all of these things may be true, but I don't think the purpose of play and the purpose of toys and the purpose of adult play is to optimize us to become efficient adults, to become better in the workplace. Education's really important, but I think there's also a place for leisure and for play. And I think there's been a kind of creeping normalization of talking about games for their hidden benefits. I've written articles like that. You know, I've fallen into this trap where someone says, hey, Tim, can you talk about the hidden benefits of games, what they can teach us, the psychological benefits, how they can help protect us against burnout? And it's really tempting to start doing that dance, playing that game of saying, hey, you know, like, actually, you're learning math skills, it's good for your mental health, it can help reduce your chances of cognitive decline as you get older. All of those things might be true, but for me, it's almost tacitly, to argue for games primarily on that basis is almost to tacitly concede the position that saying, this game, I like playing games with my friends. It makes me feel happy. I enjoy that time. It feels a valuable part of my life. That isn't enough. And I do think it is enough.
So I read a part of your book at the beginning that as the open tabletop games are ordinary and extraordinary. Ordinary because they're everywhere, and you write that that people at polar research stations are playing board games. People in Tanzania are playing board games streamed live over Twitch. And extraordinary for the same reason, everywhere in every civilization. So you go back in history. What are some of the commonalities that you find, even going back to past civilizations?
Well, we can go right back to, the Indus Valley, and we've dug up dice from... My wife always tells me off when I say we've dug up dice. She says, Tim, you're not an archaeologist. And I mean, we human beings, so, just to be clear, I've not been on any archaeological digs myself. I wasn't responsible for finding the dice in the Indus Valley. But we, as humanity, have dug up dice that are millennia old. And when I say dice, I don't mean some abstract thing that we think was used a dice. I mean a cubic six-sided dice with the dots in the same configurations that you'd see in a casino or in a board game today, right? With six and one on the other opposite side. That idea for a dice is thousands of years old. And in some sense was just so good that we were like, okay, cool, I think we'll call it a day. We won't update dice since then. Now, of course, there's been loads of different dice designs, but you can find, as well as going back, 4 or 5 millennia in places like what is now modern Iraq and India and finding dice, you can then go all the way up to the Hebrides and Scottish Islands and find knucklebone dice that are used in exactly the same way with polished sides. So these would be like sheep's ankles that have been rubbed on one side, and you can roll them and you get different results. They're functionally four-sided. Now, those civilizations on places like Skara Brae on the island of Orkney, that's a like Neolithic settlement, had no contact with Syria. And yet both communities, this isolated, windswept island facing the Arctic Ocean and the middle of the desert, both went, hey, we should invent the technology of dice. We should throw things and get random results. Now, what's fascinating to me is that these technologies don't give any civilizational advantage in the conventional sense. We can see why a civilization that invents irrigation ditches or something like that, some basis of rural agrarian economy, gets an advantage and that spreads and grows. And so, of course, they pop up here, there and everywhere. But with dice, it's not obvious, except that human beings find dice hugely fun. And to me, there's something delightful and kind of uncanny in a way. It's like dice are this idea that is inevitable.
So what do you, of course, the subtitle of your book, right? How games make us human. Is it that this part of humanity that wants fun? Is that what's going on here? This through line?
I there's different people take different positions on this. I spoke to some archaeologists who would go further than I have and have said, I talked to Dr. Lana Haddad, who is based in Baghdad, and she said, wherever you find civilization, there you find games. She thinks board games are a necessary part of the development of civilization. That in other words, games for her are a way of practicing the basics of what makes a human society, of what allows cooperation. So laws, rules, politics. I say in the book that games are like politics you can touch, because we agree on abstract rules. And then for the course of the game, those are real. So for her, it makes us human in the sense that playing a game is sort of everything that we think about living together, and language, games being a kind of language. The games are kind of a concrete embodiment of how humans relate to each other. Now, do I fully accept that position? I think it's really interesting. I'm not sure I would kind of go to the mat for it as being definitely true. I think it's an interesting conjecture. But for me, I feel like games are a kind of real generosity of attention that we share together. And I think connection and spending time with one another, I do think that's an essential part of what makes us human. And so I would say games are absolutely a key embodiment of that. And I think if we didn't play, then there would be something something fundamentally lost. You know, it was the poet and philosopher and playwright Friedrich Schiller from the Romantic period who said, "Man is only fully a man when he plays."
Do we know what the earliest game was? Can we go back that far? Is it definitive? Probably isn't, I'm guessing.
We've got the definitive earliest confirmed game, if you like. We can go back through the archaeological record and say this is the earliest thing that we know is definitely a game that we can definitely date, and that would be the Egyptian game Mehen, which is I think the earliest one of that is pre-Pharaonic Egypt, so about 5,000, 6,000 years old. Like, when you get back that far, the dating is always, you know, wide margins either side, right? And that is a game that, if I put it in front of you, you would instantly recognize as a board game. It's a snake. The board is a snake kind of coiling round to the center, like rendered in kind of clay or something like that. And each of the segments of the snake, we think, are probably squares or spaces that you move your pieces along, and they probably rolled dice. We found dice alongside the boards. We don't know how it was played, but we know it was a game. So Mehen in Egypt is the oldest one, but is that the oldest board game? Almost certainly not. The dice I've talked about that have been found in places like Mohenjo-Daro and things like that in the east, in the Indus Valley, we've found dice that are older than board games. So it's likely that dice predated board games, and that in a sense boards became, that we played dice games and maybe tracked scores in the dirt or in the sand, you know, with like a tally chart marking scores. And then maybe people one day saw that those lines of tally marks looked a bit like two horses that were racing each other, or like a race. And maybe we thought, hey, we can start tracking our scores kind of by moving pieces along a track, and the board game is born. That's speculation, but it feels like it fits the evidence we have. But there's a bunch of games that just do not leave any evidence of something that's definitely a game. You look at, just think about tic-tac-toe, right? You write that in the dirt, or you do it with a piece of chalk, and then it kind of disappears. It doesn't last. So the likelihood of there having been a load of games that existed and have just disappeared in the archaeological record, or used components that were lying around, like pebbles, like shells, in a way that we don't know that they were definitely games or not, is likely. So Mehen's the oldest attested game that we've got, but there were almost, it seems likely that it didn't just pop up out of nowhere, and that we were playing games for millennia before that.
This connection with archaeology is fascinating. You know, of course, that's how we go back and learn about these things. But there's a chapter called "To Ur is Human," talking about the royal game of Ur. This was found in a royal burial pit, right, where the queen died, and then all of her court, whether you want to or not, it's buried alive with her, right? And in that, there was this game.
Yeah, there were, in fact, around those tombs, what became known as the burial pits of Ur, that were dug up during the sort of interwar period in what is now Iraq. Those games were, the royal game of Ur, just to bring everyone in on what it looks like, if you've played something like backgammon, then you would immediately look at it and know what it is. It's a game where two players start on opposite sides of the board, move across your pieces across squares, and you're trying to get to the opposite end. And it's called, in backgammon, you bear off, right? You get to the end and you roll and you your piece is now safe. And there was a, you started from opposite ends and then both your pieces were kind of cross each other. So there was the opportunity to land on your opponents and take their pieces. And that, yeah, that was found in various people's graves, including this figure who was certainly important. She was Sir Leonard Woolley, who was the archaeologist at the time, overseeing the dig, thought that she was probably a queen. There's various views on that, but she was certainly someone of huge importance, right? She was buried, as you say, with an entire royal court, with oxen, with chariots, with, you know, big cases with all her dresses in, and with lots of people who almost certainly did not go willingly into to die with her. And there was this game. And I think that there's something, when we think about how ancient cultures thought about burials and what they were being buried with, and that, yes, you know, part of it is about status, but part of it is also comes from a belief that these objects are going to go with you into the afterlife, that essentially you're packing for a journey. I think that there's something profound about what a culture and what an individual chooses to be buried with, because that tells you what their life was like. It tells you what they valued most. And, you know, if someone decides they want to be buried with a spear, that tells you something about what they're expecting in the afterlife. And it tells you something about what their culture valued, you know, martial values. If they're buried with a game, that tells you that this must be something central to daily life.
There are, I was interested to know that apparently due to the circumstances of this particular game, Royal Game of Ur, we know how to play it, but there are other games excavated that we don't know how they were played.
There's that's actually the norm, that we don't know how to play them. The Royal Game of Ur has this absolutely wild story behind it, where Leonard Woolley digs it up, takes all these beautiful photos of it, and says, look, we're never going to know how this game was played. Unfortunately, you know, no one buried a rule book with it. And I've got his memoir from, I think it's like the 1950s, when he was now Sir Leonard Woolley. And he, you know, he laments how it was played. Sadly, we will never know. And quite reasonably, he thinks, you know, no, how would we? Because people so rarely write down how to play games, because these are oral traditions that are passed amongst people. And actually, you know, we kind of know how ubiquitous these games were, how popular they were, by the fact that people didn't generally write the rules down, because there was this sense everyone knows, you know, in the same way it's rare for us to write down how to play snakes and ladders, chutes and ladders, right? We assume everyone knows. But then in the British Museum, years later, Dr. Irving Finkel, this Assyriologist, is going through their clays and finds this thing that they've had in the collection for over 100 years and go, that was labelled for years as, this is a description of stars in the sky. This is a clay about fortune telling. And he's like, I think this might be a rules to a board game. I think the stars it's talking about might be stars on the board. And then he starts going through different ancient board games, and he finds that they've got in the museum their Royal Game of Ur, the one that was dug up in Iraq. And he's like, I think I found the rule book. And he has, and now we can play the game. That is unheard of. You know, there are many, many very popular games, including something like Senet, which is an ancient Egyptian game. Tutankhamun was buried with several Senet boards in his tomb. And do we know how to play it? We do not.
Mm-hmm. One more of the ancient games. I want to take a break and come back and talk about modern games. But your section on Roman dice was very interesting. The Romans had a loaded dice, kind of weighted dice. Part of that was cheating, right? there were complaints. I guess in all civilizations, people would cheat at the games, at least games of chance. But also, you talk about this was connected into what Romans believed, their belief in fate.
Yeah, I've heard a lot and there's been papers published about it, this idea that we've dug up lots of dice from across the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire is like huge geographically, and it's huge in terms of historical span as well. And all over Europe and Asia, we've dug up dice that came from Roman outposts. And a lot of them are odd shapes. Not all of them are what you'd call fair dice, right? They're oblong, they're kind of matchbox shaped. They're obviously unfair. And in the sense that they will roll some sides more than others. And some people have looked at that and gone, ah, this is because the Romans believed in fate. They believed in the will of the gods. They believed that, you know, whatever god was had the portfolio for looking after their dice game that day was controlling it. It didn't matter what shape the dice was. So the reason that they didn't care about it is because they thought that the gods, not physics, controlled the fall of the dice. Now, my contention is that I don't think Romans would have had quite so many elaborate cheating dice devices, like you say, you know, like really amazing ones as well, with like secret chambers inside the dice that had liquid mercury so you could tilt the dice. So it was a loaded dice where you could change which face that was weighted depending on what you wanted in that moment, right? I don't think Romans would have bothered with that if they genuinely mostly believed that gods were controlling the fall of dice. I think that that is a way that we sometimes look back on ancient civilizations and think of them as being these kind of weird, superstitious creatures who aren't quite like us. I think that the Romans were actually probably the most dice-obsessed civilization that has ever existed. And I think most Romans would be intimately familiar with the bounce of dice. And so for me, it's a really interesting theory. It's really fun. I understand why it's been spread around. But for me, I know and believe that the many Romans believed in the gods and fate, but I don't think that that meant that if they saw somebody rolling a dice that was shaped like an eraser or a matchbox, that they wouldn't have challenged that person and said, hey, are you cheating?
Let's take a break. We'll come back with more with Tim Clare, his latest book out and available now. Very interesting book called Across the Board, How Games Make Us Human. We'll have more following this break. Thanks for listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking with Tim Clare, his latest book out and available now. It's called Across the Board, How Games Make Us Human. Tim Clare, I want to, due to time, skip over several chapters, including Chapter 5, the obligatory Monopoly chapter. I love that title. And you get into the contested, disputed origin story of Monopoly. I want to go straight to a game I didn't know about until I read your book, the Japanese game Karuta. Tell me about this extraordinary game.
I'm really excited by the response that people have had to Karuta, this Japanese card game, because I felt like I was taking a huge risk, including it in the book, because people would be like, well, why are you talking about this? Because I've never heard of it. Karuta is a game that in some ways is very difficult to describe. My quick description would be, imagine a cross between Snap and Sumo, and you're half the way there. It's a game where basically it's a game of physical dexterity and memory, where players have cards laid out in front of them. It's played with two players generally, the competitive version at least. And you have cards laid out in front of you, and they're the second half. On each card is written the second half of a famous Japanese poem. And you have 25 each laid out in front of you. And then an announcer reads out the first half of one of those poems. And the first person to identify which is the matching card and slap it out of the way wins that card, well, gets to remove it from their side of the board. And your aim is to clear your side of the table first. So I guess it's, you know, you can imagine it if we were doing it with Shakespeare quotes, and if someone someone, the announcer said, to be or not to be, and you looked around and you saw the card that said, that is the question, and you slapped it out the way, that would be the matching one. That's how Karuta works. And it's a game that's played, I should say, there's, you know, there are lots of casual versions where people will play with kind of matching up movie quotes or things like that. But the classic competitive version is played with this very strict list of 100 historical famous Japanese poems, and is played by people who take it very, very seriously indeed.
In fact, somebody in that chapter told you the first time you play Karuta is like falling in love. And someone else talked about how playing Karuta with someone really reveals to you your opponent's, I guess, true nature. The fact that that person said, you know, number of people, I guess, they've known have ended up together after playing Karuta together.
I would say it is, I'd say it's definitely a very intimate experience. Not in a creepy or uncomfortable way. Well, it is uncomfortable in the sense that if you're not Japanese, then you probably aren't so used to kind of squatting or crouching, and it's quite hard on your knees. Like, that's what I would say. You spend the entire game, which lasts an hour each match, in a kind of sprinter's crouch. And that is hard to maintain if you're used to sitting on chairs rather than sitting cross-legged or on the floor. But it's like a game where, you know, if you've ever played a game like Snap, where you're kind of waiting to see whether the card matches before you claim the pile, you're held in that tension for most of an hour, watching the other person and watching the cards, doing this incredible feat of memory that I've played the game and I'm not good at it, and I see how hard it is. And I think just being under that level of stress while being all of 2 feet away from somebody else, certainly if you're someone who under pressure gets frustrated, lashes out, it's going to be very hard to disguise that. But also, I think I got the sense from the people I spoke to actually that it's also, if you're a very competitive person, you're not going to be able to disguise your glee when you win. You're not going to be able to disguise that moment of being like, yes, all right. And if culturally you've been taught that maybe it's a bit unseemly to be super competitive, which I think is sometimes true in across a bunch of cultures with women who, you know, it's less normalized to be totally kind of in your face like, yeah. I think sometimes that's difficult. You know, that's difficult for some people to let that side out. But I think it's also supremely healthy. And the people I spoke to who played Karuta really got something out of having a space where it is acceptable to be really, really competitive.
You know, some games are more popular, some are less. Some, you know, wax and wane. You note in the book that bridge seems to be dying out a bit, while poker is being televised to it. Are there any commonalities of games that sort of fade and other games that become very popular?
Well, what I would say about, before, you know, bridge fans come for me saying that I'm predicting bridge's demise, bridge has died many times before and been resurrected in new forms. You know, the ancestor of bridge is any number of a bunch of trick-taking games, which are, you know, games where you all play a card and the highest card or whatever the rules for that game are wins each of those cards, and whoever's got the most tricks at the end wins. That is, bridge is part of a long legacy and family of games in that genre. And while I sort of think the writing is on the wall for bridge itself as an individual game, I think it is a trick-taking games have never been in ruder health. They're the cool thing at the moment within the kind of board game hobby space. Everybody's making trick-taking games. All of these games are, you know, people are really getting very nerdy. The kind of equivalent of like the like cool person that you would see hanging out at a record store buying very kind of like arty experimental music or whatever. Those are the people who are buying trick takers at the moment. So I think bridge itself is a game that is sort of seeing its community not find new players. And that could turn around. You know, I would never say never. lots of games have surprised people with how they find and invigorate their community. But without an injection and an influx of new players, I don't see Bridge in itself continuing, because every game is a kind of living game, and the way it lives is its community. And Bridge is just one of those games that's wonderfully complex, and also that makes it a little bit of a steep learning curve for new people. And I think that's what it suffered from recently, is just finding it hard to recruit new players. But Bridge will come back in a new form, I have no doubt whatsoever.
Many of these games, of course, you have to go and read the book to hear Tim Clare talk about them, the Dungeons & Dragons, or at Magic the Gathering. I want to have you just have a 2 minutes left here. We have to let you go here by 45 past. You have a fascinating chapter on live-action role-playing games, and specifically a live-action role-playing game which was a collaboration between Palestinian and Nordic groups. Just give us your two-minute version of that.
Yeah, the group in Finland and the group in Palestine worked together to create. They both worked together to create LARPs, live action role playing games, which are like a kind of version. It's like making a theatre play where everybody, there's no audience. Everybody is a character, and it's all improvised, but it might have a setting. And they did one in Ramallah in Palestine that was it didn't have a political dimension particularly. There was a wedding, right? There was a wedding being held in Palestine, and the premise of it was that a bunch of a Palestinian bride was marrying a Scandinavian husband, and so these two groups came together, and a lot of the Scandinavians in the story, but also in real life, had never been to Palestine before. And so there were a bunch of funny cultural misunderstandings. And of course, the way the story was written, the main characters went into it, having some secrets, having some disagreements, different characters having different agendas. Now, the plot of these things is never worked out in advance. You're just told your character has this feeling, maybe they secretly have a resentment towards their new mother-in-law or whatever. And then these things are just played out. People improvise, people work through them and hang out together. And, you know, in the same way that people do like a murder mystery weekend, really. But in this kind of setting where they really were in Palestine, and there really were cultural misunderstandings and differences that players were having to navigate. And I think what some of the players told me was that having that fiction of like, I'm somebody's kind of like goofy boss who's come over and been invited to the wedding, means that they actually had kind of an alibi and permission to ask the dumb questions, to kind of go, what food is this? What's happening now? What's this song playing? Is this a Palestinian tradition? And to not feel bad, because they could say, it's my character being dumb, not me.
Well, there's much in the book. You'll have to read it. It's out and available now. Fascinating read across the board, How Games Make Us Human. And we've been talking with the author, Tim Clare. Tim Clare, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
And thanks, everyone, for listening to Access Utah.